The story of the Forgotten Village was a story about a little boy who was kind of torn between, well, listen, he was a young man, probably 18, torn between the old customs of an old village of how they treated diseases like diseases you could get from drinking water or from eating bad food or bad sewage or something like that. And through a teacher, he found out that there was a lot of these other elements were causing these diseases, and he tried to impress on his father and the other people in the village that they were going about this the wrong way and that they should adopt these new modern medicines and all that, instead of listening to witch doctors putting eggs on your stomach or rattle skins on your skin or something and drawing the pain out. So he was torn between this and then the final scenes of the where they reject all his thing and his father turns his back on him and the boy has to leave the village, and they went back to what they had been doing and all that. They rejected this the modern medicines and all that. And that was the basically that story. In the meantime, after the movie came out, Rose and Herbert had decided they had started having financial problems and everything else. She had bought a home in Benedict Canyon in Hollywood, became very good friends with the Gershwins, well, not George, but Ira and his wife, and lived with them for a while. And Rose and Herbert got a divorce, and she became a still photographer. She was a stringer for Look magazine out on the coast and all that. And then felt there wasn't that big of a market in New York, in Los Angeles for still photography, she decided to go to New York City, because the markets were bigger, more magazines and more editors and everything else. She came to New York City, and in time she met Alan Chellis, who she married. Alan was a writer, freelance writer. They did stories for all through Europe on for Holiday magazine and did some for Look and all that. And one day she decided, the heck with this. After a few years, she decided, I don't want this anymore. She looked around Connecticut, found this big home. Scraped up the money and bought it. Had like 15 rooms up in Redding Ridge. Bought this home, and they lived there a while until it got too big for them. So they took the carriage house, remodeled that, and sold the big house for a big profit, And they remodeled the carriage house, and that's where she lived up until the day she died. Never cared much after that. The only thing that really interested her later on. She got interested in the Molly Maguires, and she wanted to do a novel. And we were talking about Franklin Gowan, and she based her central character on the life of Franklin Gowan and a young girl, that he fell in love with. And the book was called Caitlin. The entire manuscript is down at the Canal Museum now. Lance has had it. They've been reading it now for the last year or something. I don't know whether it'll ever be published. She spent a lot of time researching. I helped her research, and that's how I got interested in the Molly Maguires. She would call me and say, "Can I go to the Pottsville Library and do this or that?" And I had no idea who the Molly Maguires were around here. There was a
When you were growing up, they weren't a story that was
no,
particularly
no. The only
common.
the first time I really got that, well, when I got involved with it was after the war, when I came back to Lansford. But it was a funny thing. I was thinking about this not recently that we had a bunch of, when we were growing up, we had a lot of big families around here, a lot of ethnic families, mostly Slovak, Polish, and we'd go up on Ridge Street, we'd play, up in the night, we'd have all kind of games and things like that. And we used to play right in front of the house where Alexander Campbell lived and John Jones lived. Alexander Campbell was one that was hung for the murder of John Jones, And we actually played right in front of their homes, because they lived across the street, and we played there, and we were living in this kind of a historical place, you know, as far as the Mullen McGuire's were concerned, and we never even knew it, you know. So, like I said, we had a lot of big families around here. We all had nicknames, too, you know. We all had, everybody had a nickname.
So what were you called?
I was called a lot. I was called JoJo. I was called Sheriff, you know. And we had Dula and Mooney and Tilly, and, you know, and Bunzer, you know. And they're practically all gone now.
Did either one of those kids go into the mines?
No, because we were about the age when we got out of high school. You could have gone into the mines maybe a year, but then the war broke out, and then you went into the service, you know. If you were in the mines and were drafted, you had your job when you came back. They gave your job back. I never went into the mines, because when I got out of high school, I couldn't get a job in the mines. I couldn't get a job anywhere. Every week I would go down. Roosevelt had initiated the Civilian Conservation Corps. It was a program set up for youth to get them off the streets and put them going into places and doing some good, you know, planting trees or building roads or whatever. And every week we had to go down to Jim Thorpe, who was Mo Chunk at the time, and sign up. If you missed the day, if you missed the week, they would take you off the list. So you had to bum a ride down there and or get a ride somehow and sign up every week.
And this was just a waiting list.
A waiting list, yeah. Then they'd try to take the people who they felt were more deserving, you know. So when your term came up, they called you. And I would go down and sign up. And after about 6 months or so, they called me. And I spent 2 years in the Civilian Conservation Corps before I went in, you know, after. That was my main employment. It was, we got $1 a day, $30 a month. You kept $6 and $22 went home, and that $22 was a big help to them at home. You're talking 39, height of the depression, 40, you know, and
your father wasn't working much in the mines.
No, and the mine, no one was. They were scraping together. You know, the mines at that time were pretty well finished, you know, as far as at that time. The only thing that really rejuvenated them was the Second World War then. And this was just an interlude, and the rest was a carryover from the 39s and 40s into the 47s, or 55s, 56s, and 57s, and all that, yeah. And that's how I got into CCs. I spent 2 years in the CCs.
Where did you do your work?
In the CCs.
Were you living at home and doing it?
Oh, no, no, no. They packed you off and they put you on a train and they send you to a camp. They sent me down to Waynesboro. It's on the border of the line of the Maryland, near west of Gettysburg, but more on the borderline of Maryland and Pennsylvania. There was two camps there. There was a forestry camp and SES camp, which is soil conservation camp, and I was in a soil conservation camp, and we went out into different farmers who needed terraces made, or had maybe they had wanted to block off a pasture for cattle or something. They would put up fence and all that. It was real hard work, but you were young then, you know, and you get out there in the summertime and all that, and you know, you were really hard at the time. They fed you, gave you clothes. We had three good meals. We had a breakfast, then we'd get in the truck, and they would move us out to a farm or where we were going to work, and then after the day's work, at lunchtime, they would have a truck would come out with huge vats, you know, with food and all that. And they had a regular mess kit. They would scoop the food into your mess kit, and you would eat it. And they had coffee and things like that, and bread and all that. And I did that for a year and a half. I worked my way up then to an assistant leader. After a year, I became an assistant leader, and I got $36 a month. I was able to keep $12, you know, so, or $14. And then the last 6 months I was in the CC camps, they sent me up to New Cumberland. It's a small town south of Harrisburg. Was kind of a replacement center for other CC boys. But by that time, the CCs were... people were losing interest in all that, and this was, you're talking 41, you know, 40, latter part of 40, 41, early 41, and they were sending, my job there was to take rookie boys, and I was just a young man at the time, you know, I was only 20 years old, so I was taking young men to other camps. I remember going down to Camp David now, they were building that camp and all that, where the President Retreat and Front Royal and down into Kentucky and all that. And I'd pick them up in New Cumberland, put them on a train, and we'd go there, and I would drop them off and then come back and all that. And it was kind of an experience for a young man, you know, to see the country and meet all these people. And you would meet all kinds, you know. I mean, one time we got this bunch of kids in from South Philadelphia. Most of them were Italians, you know, really rough. And brother, it was tough. I was fortunate. The leader of the group, I became good friends of and all that, so everything I was, and he could have clobbered me because he was so much bigger than me, and but I became good friends of them, and then that way I survived, I think. I think you have to be a little diplomatic. That's another thing I learned, you know. Another interesting thing in the CC camps, there was another fellow from Philadelphia, an Italian boy also, who one day, he was a leader at the time, and I was assistant leader. He said, you know, we could make some money. And I said, how's that? He said, I'm going to buy two pigs. We're going to go back and make a pen back in there, and all the slop that they take out of the mess hall, he said, we're going to take the slop up there, and we're going to feed them, and then we're going to get these two big pigs, and they said we could take it in the town, you know, and sell it and make some money. So we did that. After a while, we had the two most huge pigs you'd ever want to see, because they had all this food that was left over from the mess hall, and they were huge. They were so big we finally got a hold of the truck when they were sitting. We took them into town. And the people in Waynesboro never really liked us, you know, because we were so close, and it was kind of, I could understand almost how, not quite like the blacks, but, you know, I mean, being an outcast in a town and all that, they wouldn't have nothing to do with us. On Saturday night, we would never head for Waynesboro. We'd go to Hagerstown, which was further away, and it was a little bigger town, and they had dances and stuff like that, and after we had our bottle of wine or something, we didn't care where we were, you know. But we took these two pigs into town into a butcher in Waynesboro, and we couldn't get anything for them. They wouldn't. They knew we were, you know, if we couldn't sell it to them, they, you know, so they practically stole the pigs on us, you know. So we didn't make any money anyway.